Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. Today, just about everything that we do involves the processing, storage, and transmission of data. The networks of computers that do this processing consume vast amounts of energy. And for the time being, at least, these computers make significant contributions to greenhouse gas emissions. As a result, some scientists are rethinking how they use computing resources, especially those who run lengthy simulations on energy-hungry supercomputers. In this episode, Physics World's Margaret Harris meets theoretical materials physicists in Spain who are concerned about the carbon footprint of their work. They talk about what the physics community should be doing to reduce its negative impact on the environment.
I'm speaking with Alejandra Gaita and Herluz Gutierrez of the Institute of Molecular Science in Valencia, Spain. They're passionate about the environment and the fight against climate change, and they've recently been making efforts to translate this passion into the way they do their research. Hello, Alex. Hello, Herluz. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
So maybe you could start by saying just generally what your research is about.
Yeah, for sure. We have been working on probabilistic bits all this year. Probabilistic bits, or just p-bits, are in the middle of classic bits of digital electronics and on qubits of quantum computing. But we all know that stable magnets are also built of a spin. It's just that due to the internal interactions, they are aligned in one direction or another. And this is the result of the high barrier that they have. So usually if you put a magnet in one state, it will want to stay in that state for a very long time. The problem is when we want them to be smaller. So this barrier height is not big enough. So if you put this small magnet in that state, it will want to go to the other state or and come back. And this back and forth process could last milliseconds, microseconds, or even nanoseconds, depending on this barrier height. But our work was born just with a simple idea or question. Given a molecular structure, what would be its spin dynamic? Because this is not easy or computationally cheap trying to predict the magnetic behavior due to the molecular structure. So we developed custom implementation of a Markov-Chape Monte Carlo algorithm, which is based in random transitions and Boltzmann distribution to calculate the probabilities of each spin to change its state. So basically, it's our job, a part of our job, because we were studying another complex system, but not in the area of p-bits.
Yeah, maybe adding a bit more perspective.
Mm-hmm,
but
sure.
I've been working for many years in magnetic molecules, trying to use them either as stable bits or as quantum bits. And in general, it's an interesting field, you know, but they are really bad at it. And we've been fighting for years and failing for years to make them stable. And then a colleague found that there was something called probabilistic bits, where the stochastic changing was part of the required nature of the object instead of a problem. So if we cannot get rid of the problem, but we find another use where it's actually required that the bit randomly changes its value, then it's okay. Maybe you should explore our system, because if a probabilistic bit is a bad bit or a bad qubit, we have so many of those. So
yeah,
we decided to like switch gears and try to do something with those.
So I'm imagining sort of a line or an array of magnetic spins that are flipping randomly, and that's the system you're trying to model.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And ideally, they have to talk to each other if
right.
We want to do some computation with them.
Okay. So, you know, some of our listeners may be surprised to hear that this type of research has much of an impact on the environment. I mean, there are other areas of physics and materials research where the link is much more obvious. You know, for example, CERN's Large Hadron Collider uses so much energy that it actually shuts down pretty much every winter to save electricity costs and also to avoid straining the grid. In your case, where are these emissions coming from when you're modeling these systems of magnetic spins?
So I can maybe start with that because it's not as intense as the extreme cases, but I think it's a matter of knowing what you are doing. So we are, in the last years, everyone, we have been a bit more aware as consumers with what we are buying or well, the services we are using, whether they are more or less energy or carbon intensive, but also maybe as workers, as producers, we can use methods that are more or less carbon intensive. So in our case, it's less extreme, but in many cases, as Gerlit was pointing out, the modeling of these things is not at all obvious. It's not a solved problem. And in general, what we do, what people do in the field, is to throw a lot of computational power into it to solve complicated quantum models. And then they do need to do simplifications because they are limited by the computer that they have or the computer time they have access to. But in general, you can spend many thousands of hours trying to understand not even the dynamics, but just the static structure of the spin energy levels of a given molecule and something about how it evolves in time. And then that, while it does not compare to something citywide, it is something comparable to what you use as a consumer.
And it's kind of funny because I remember when we were performing our simulations in the biggest case that we had, it lasted almost 10 hours. And we were so happy because, I mean, if we compared that amount of time to another kind of, I don't know, maybe AB initial simulations, there is almost any kind of big amount of time. But we weren't comfy about that time. So we started to think about what if maybe using another programming language could help us to decrease the computational cost. And we did it. And in that case, in the biggest case, that simulation lasted only 10 minutes. I mean, wow. We are not saying which programming language is better. It's just the idea behind, because we need to start treating computational resources as finite and precious, just like an author was saying, and only use it when it's necessary and frugally as possible. So the main idea behind when we said, no, our last simulation just lasts 10 minutes. So you can do it with many cases, but it's not that idea. It's not that idea that we want to explore. It's just that we solve the problem that we were having, and that's it. We can explore another scenarios for sure, but only when it's necessary or not.
Yeah, she's referring to the rebound effect or the Gibbons paradox, that the natural, the common tendency in our culture or societies, if you can get the same computation in 10 minutes instead of in 10 hours, everyone's reaction is, okay, then let's explore 1,000 systems.
Right, right.
Right, up to the maximum, you have a cluster with whatever hundreds or thousands of processors, and then you don't want it to be idle. Ideally, you should use it all the time and then get as maximum as you can and then probably get more papers out of it or whatever. And we think that's not the way that the planet or our civilization can handle right now.
So that's interesting because, you know, traditionally, as you say, you know, sort of the limits on how much computational power you can use for a computation is the limits are cost, you know, how much time do you have to pay for their money, how much money do you have to spend on your own cluster or computational resource, or their time, which is, you know, how long do you want to wait for your code to run. So you can make all those things more efficient, but you then still end up spending more energy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If you do more things. So that's an interesting perspective. I mean, I think a lot of listeners to this podcast would agree on balance that scientific research, you know, figuring out the mysteries of the universe, figuring out how this model system works, is actually a pretty good use of carbon budgets, especially compared to some other things that humans mm-hmm. do. So surely we shouldn't just sort of stop doing that.
No. Yeah, of course. But what I think is that I think it's an ethical concern, and then that we should just be aware of what we are doing and at what cost. So, like there's an infinite amount of scientific questions, I think. So we cannot answer all of them. So we should not feel the burden to answer all of them. And because we have a limited time on Earth as individual humans, we just choose, right, the questions that we can answer. And we accept ethical limitations in other aspects, like we don't do, like, right, in general, experimentation on unwilling humans. And we are also scaling back the experimentation on other animals. And here we think there's also ethical concerns about the consequences of what we are doing. So we need to check, like, what's the carbon budget we want to accept for certain amount of tragedy that's already ongoing, and that we know as scientists, we understand as scientists how this will scale up in the coming years, in the coming decades. And then sure, it's worth it to make the tragedy a bit more intense and gain science in the process, but not indefinitely intense. The more science, even at a cost of the more tragedy, the better, not necessarily. Let's do something that is reasonable. And you can answer an important scientific question in 10 hours of computing or in 10 minutes of computing, then it's better to choose this question rather than another that requires 10,000 hours. It's what I'm saying.
Yeah, just having in mind that the energy is not infinite. And of course, it's not free.
We had someone in the institute claiming as an answer to a question about the energy costs of what they were doing, saying, no, but the energy is free. It's okay, we need to change this, right? We cannot be saying in public energy is free.
It was a scientist.
Yeah, there is no problem. You just put solar panels and energy is free. We cannot be saying these things.
So how much carbon is actually involved in running that computation that takes 10 hours or a computation that takes, as you say, 10,000 hours? What are the differences we're talking about?
So we just published a paper that linked to an online calculator. And then if you put like a common novel, like a recent desktop with whatever 16 gigabytes of RAM or so, and then if you do calculations that take about like 12 hours, it was like a 1-point-something kilometer of driving a car. So it's something that you should not worry about. Like having your computer on is, if you drive any amount, then having your computer on is not changing your
carbon footprint
on the planet yet. But if you instead of having one computer, you have a supercomputer and you are doing 10,000 hours of calculations, then depending on where you live also, but this may have an equivalent effect of whatever, driving 1,000 kilometers or taking a short or medium distance flight. And there's also in this webpage the possibility of saying where you are, because what you use is electricity. Electricity in itself does not have a defined carbon cost. So if your electricity comes in Australia and in India, it was really carbon intensive, while in Switzerland, it was way less than in Spain. In Spain, where we are, it was like somewhere in the middle. It was like 20% for the same amount of computing. We generate 20% the same amount of carbon as they do in Australia or in India, and maybe 10 times more or 20 times more than in Switzerland.
So that's actually really quite significant amount of carbon. I think many listeners won't realize that taking a long-haul flight or even a short-haul flight is similar sort of carbon footprint to running an intensive computation.
Yeah, that's what we think, that in many cases, some scientists have been aware of the cost of flying, and we are scaling back our flights. So in the same sense, we could be scaling down or being more aware of our computational intensity.
So I understand that to test these ideas, you modeled this particular physical system that you work on in a couple different ways. Tell us what those ways were and what was the difference in computing time and in CO2 cost.
We tried to model the system just using the same, let's say, body of the code, but just using another language. But the main difference here, just related to the language program, it's just that for loops. So we have the same amount of functions but just writing in a different language. So that's the reason I think that maybe just because inside of the program language, using a compiler, it's different. Because if you use a strong typed programming language, it could be easier to compile, to translate the code to the computer language, just binary code. And yeah, that is the main difference. But in fact, it was the same code, the same body of the code, but just using another style.
So that was one case, the one of the 10 minutes to 10 hours. And then there was another coming from a different paper where the difference were mostly in the theory. So we used an ab initio calculation from a commercial code that had a lot of quantum chemistry into it. And this is something we did on one side. And in parallel, we did this on a system that was based on point charges that was very simple, that had way less physics into it. But in many cases, especially if the changes, it's a parametric model. So if you parameterize it correctly, then and you change very little the distances, the atomic positions, then the calculations are basically just as good or similarly good compared with the quantum one. The difference is that the quantum one is, in principle, it's optimal, but this in principle means if you have infinite computational power. Because in quantum mechanics, we can do really well the hydrogen atom, and for everything else, we start doing approximations. And then our molecules, they are molecules, but they are chemical molecules, not what the physicists call molecules, which are a few atoms. So they have hundreds of atoms, thousands of electrons. So if you try to consider everything, it's impossible. So even if you are going to spend 10,000 hours of calculational type, you have to make so many, you have to do so many simplifications that in the end, the result is not much better when you compare it with the experiment with a very simple parametric point charge model.
So you're saying you can get essentially the same scientific result out of the frugal model as you can out of the computationally and carbon intensive model.
Yes, that's what we are saying. And even within the same model, by changing the implementation, you can still save more.
So are these methods sort of equally well accepted in the community? You know, if you publish a paper where you use the inexpensive model, would someone come along and say, hey, you've got to use a better model that's going to be more expensive?
Yeah, exactly. That's basically what happened to us. But I think it's a general problem that in science, We don't consider the expense. So if you prove something with two methods, it's okay. But if you prove it with five methods, it's better, right? Because if you just think of the output, it is better. The more proof you have for something, the better it is. But for the actual work, for the consequences in engineering and in outside of the academia, the cost is important. So if you get any kind of machine that is a bit more functional, but it costs 10 times more, then it's a worse machine. It's not better because it is a bit better. It's a bit better, but if it costs much more, then we accept that this is something to consider. And that maybe in publications, we should also start considering it, not just adding more, asking for more proof, but if things are of a quality that people can accept, okay, this seems to be correct, this seems to be true, we don't see any obvious problem with that, then don't ask for methods that have a cost for everyone, for all of us.
What changes would you like to see happen? You mentioned that, you know, sort of getting people to accept that using a good enough model is, well, enough for the result you need to have and not asking for the Rolls Royce of computational models. What other changes would you like to see happen in terms of reducing the carbon footprint of theoretical calculations in physics?
We were discussing yesterday of the general needs in society, not just in science and within science, not just in theoretical computation, that we have been living for a long time in borrowed time, like we have been spending resources that are not renewable and that are gone forever. Every time we use some carbon, some natural gas, some oil, it's gone forever, and we don't know how to replace it at anything resembling the rate of usage. So I think we should learn something from either the places that are currently forced to do with less, or remember in other places that are currently doing better, how people did manage a generation or two ago. Like in Spain, we are currently, let's say, okay, but my parents, my grandparents lived in a very different world, and they reused, they had a lot of customs that in some cases we could retake, because now we realize we need to do that. We thought everyone was rich, but we were living on the richness of non-renewable resources, carbon and oil and so on.
Related to that is something that I want to say, because I am from Venezuela. So there, doing science there is quite difficult, because we don't have the opportunity to have many resources because of the huge economic problem that the country has been having all these years. But I remember when I was a professor there, so we did science, yeah, but with restricted resources. So we needed to do things just with the tools that we had. And in many cases, we didn't have few options, just one, and that's it. So there is an important question here, because it is, what is the advantage of that? Of, I mean, if you have many options or opportunity or tools to develop your research with a huge amount of money, is that better of doing with, okay, with a high efficiency? But in those cases, when you don't have a cutting edge technology, you only have the opportunity to use a small amount of tools that don't have efficiency or enough efficiency. So is that related to the country that we are doing science?
It sounds like it could be almost a question of access to being able to do research, yeah, as well as just the carbon footprint of the research that you do. Because if you have an acceptance that it's okay to do research using frugal computing approach, as long as it gets you good results, or as good results as you would get with a more expensive model, then that would presumably open up this type of research to people at more institutions around the world.
And related to this, I think a simple, let's say, catchphrase for a change that I would like to see in academia would be hire more people, buy less stuff, right? Because every human has a carbon footprint just to be alive. And I'm going to have a similar carbon footprint whether I'm on unemployment or whether I'm working. So people that are working are more productive. People on unemployment still have to eat and still have medical expenses and everything else. So it's better if we can be working, and the more people working with less stuff can also sometimes produce more science, maybe. Because sometimes few people have a lot of access to a lot of machines and they don't use them at their maximum possibilities because they don't have time to think about the inputs or to check the outputs. And then sometimes calculations are run over the weekend, and then on Monday you see, oh, actually this, all of this was wrong. Let's start again. Right? So if you have less machines and one more person to check what you are doing, maybe you will get better, like more science out of the same money and less carbon footprint.
What was it that really got you thinking about this problem, this question of how to reduce carbon footprint in computing?
In my case, I can see a specific clue for this direction, rather than in general being aware of a huge climate problem that we are having as a society. And then you try to look at your everyday and say, okay, what am I doing? And then should I drive less? Should I fly less? What choices do I have with what I buy? And then because I'm not just a consumer, but also a producer, a worker, then also in my work, how should I behave to be less responsible of a huge problem?
to be conscious about the problem, to know it, and try to lead all research and the way that we do science with an ethic value.
Alex and Herlis, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
That was Alejandro Gaeta and Herlis Gutierrez in conversation with Physics World's Margaret Harris. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to our guests and to our producer, Fred Isles. We'll be back again next week, but in the meantime, why not have a look at some of the exciting content on the Physics World website? If you're a fan of puzzles and quantum physics, we have a new quantum cryptic word search for your delight. It's been put together by our games master, Ian Randall, and you can find it under the headline, "Can You Solve This Quantum Cryptic Word Search?" If modified theories of gravity are more to your liking, the science writer Keith Cooper has embarked on a three-part investigation of how such theories offer an alternative to dark matter when it comes to explaining the large-scale structure of the universe. The first installment is called Cosmic Combat, delving into the battle between dark matter and modified gravity. And if that's whetted your appetite, the latest episode of the Physics World Stories podcast features two experts, one who champions dark matter and the other who advocates modified gravity. That episode is called Dark Matter versus Modified Gravity, Which Team Are You On? And you can find it on the Physics World website or at your favorite podcast provider.
Physics World.